Now, the relation between the mind and the brain has fascinated philosophers and scientists since Plato, and it's still something of a mystery how the collection of neurons and synapses inside our skull actually makes up the person each one of us is. But whatever the true mechanism of the brain, Australia's been hearing firsthand in this past month that it isn't fixed, that it's much more malleable, more plastic than we've realised. And of course, this is a most inviting prospect to post-postmodern types who like to have more and more of their life under their control, and that they're really not sort of governed by fate. Dr. Norman Doidge has been wowing audiences at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. He's a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. He's deeply absorbed in the new science of neuroplasticity, which studies how the brain can rewire and repair itself. And its potential is, well, limitless. Norman Doidge's re-released book about this science is called The Brain That Changes Itself. And I managed to catch up with him during a busy schedule.
Thank you for having me.
You, in fact, visited the Brisbane Writers' Festival last year. You're back for the Brisbane and the Melbourne this year.
Mm-hmm.
And something rather extraordinary occurred to you there, which actually is pertinent to all your work with brain plasticity. Could you tell us the story, please?
Well, I was in there was a queue for signing books, as I recall, and a woman came up to me, and her name was Jane Gapp, and she said, you know, I've just torn myself away from my daughter's bedside. She was in one of the local hospitals in Brisbane, and she said she has locked-in syndrome. And that just is one of the worst possible outcomes of a stroke. Her daughter was only 21 years old. Sarah was a legal assistant hoping to become a lawyer. Beautiful young girl. And she had a stroke. You know, one in six people have strokes. And more people have strokes when they're younger than most people are aware of, but this is the worst outcome because you're buried alive in your own body. You cannot move any of your muscles except your eyelids.
But your cognitive functions are all right.
Yeah. All right, but it's just terrifying. And the only way people with locked-in syndrome can communicate is to blink. So if you look up Wikipedia on locked-in syndrome, it says there is no treatment, there is no cure, and that 90% of people die from this syndrome. And in fact, my own father died of a brainstem lesion in a terrible fall when I was a baby, down an elevator shaft. So
this made a big impact on you.
Yeah, I mean, there was just an element of, you know, shudder and pain. And she said, can neuroplasticity help my daughter? And I knew of no case where anyone had even tried it with locked-in syndrome. And, you know, neuroplasticity is the most important change in our understanding of the brain in 400 years, and it's given rise to these extraordinary treatments. And I have seen many, many positive results that most people, you know, wouldn't even credit, but I've seen it with my own eyes. But I hadn't, and I had to tell her the truth. I said, I hadn't seen anything. And I think I said something the effect of, she might have said something like, she was devastated, and what do I do? And I think I said something like, you know, apply the principles that you see in the book. Now, one of the things, she'd come to two of my lectures. One of the points I often make is, although we often think of the brain as having parts that have to do with sensation and other parts that have to do with motor activity, in fact, the process of sensing the world is bound up with motor activity. If you lose your glasses at night in the hotel, you move your hands around on the dark floor to try to find the glasses. Mm. The way we sort of sense with our hands shows, you know, that we take sensory input and we use movement. And our eyes do the same thing. And the way we move isn't all just about motor activity. It's also about sensing where things are. So there had been some work done on people with comas. In fact, in Australia, where the family starts to move the limbs and stroke the limbs and touch the limbs, because it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain. And the danger in all these neurological conditions is if you have a problem, it just goes into a shutdown mode. We call this learned non-use.
Yes.
and basically processing areas start to wither away. Well, you know, Sarah basically was getting rehab by her mother. I mean, all her mother's waking hours. And when she couldn't move, they stroked her limbs with different textured things just to awaken things. And at 3.5 months, Sarah started to come out of locked-in syndrome. And at 5 months, she came out of locked-in syndrome. So Sarah now has some movement and communicates and can write. Her mother taught her to write.
Now, just before we go on, I just think we should then define what is plasticity of the brain?
Neuroplasticity of the brain is that property of the brain which allows it to change its structure and function through mental experience. So for 400 years, we thought we had the mind over here and the brain over there. And following Descartes, who was the biggest neuroscientist, if you will, of his time, we thought mind is immaterial and works by certain laws, and the brain is material and works by other laws, the mechanical laws of motion and the laws of physics. And that led to a division of the sciences and the clinical disciplines. So some people became phenomenological psychologists and interested in subjectivity, and other people are just interested in studying cells and chemicals. And what neuroplasticity does, and what I think neuroscience properly understood does, is it brings all these disciplines together. And it concedes this extraordinary fact of human existence, which is that our minds can influence the physical structures of our bodies. I mean, I will to raise my right hand, and this is radio, but you will attest that I am raising my right hand. What is that if not mind somehow or other influencing physical structure? Neuroplasticity takes this insight very, very far. And we've now documented in the lab that when you train, for instance, snails, this is Nobel Prize work, you can see the connections between the neurons developing and strengthening and doubling from 1,300 connections to twice that in a four-hour training session. And the book, The Brain That Changes Itself, is about all the clinical and I would say cultural implications of this most extraordinary discovery.
Can I, because I've so many questions, and I'll try to go through some that I know people will say. There's no doubt learning is easier for children than adults. So is there some increase in rigidity despite this plasticity notion, or is that the wrong way of looking at it?
We discovered in the 1960s that there were critical periods of brain plasticity when, which you see particularly in infants, where they don't even have to make an effort to pay attention and they can learn. That's how children, young children, pick up language. And there are different critical periods for different mental functions. And after a while, these critical periods close, and then you can learn, but you have to pay effortful attention. However, you may become more motivated as you're older and you understand it. But yes, there are epochs of plasticity throughout life. There's a pruning back of connections that happens in adolescence. But for the last 40 years, all mainstream thinkers in almost all mainstream thinkers in biology and psychology and psychiatry and neurology had a fundamental fact wrong, and that is we assumed that the circuits of the brain were formed and finalized in childhood, and that's not true. There is plasticity from cradle to grave, and if you know the laws or the principles of plasticity, you can do remarkable things until the day you die, including turning back your memory so that 80-year-olds can start to function the way they did when they were 60.
I was going to leave this to the end, but I can't now. The story of Dr. Stanley Karansky is just wonderful, of course. As I'm aging, I read it with great interest. A doctor who continued to throw himself fully into new interests, because you're quite adamant. He would, well, you can tell the story of why he is such a good example, I think you believe, of the theories you're proposing.
Well, Stanley Karansky, I spoke with him when he was 89 years old. And what was exceptional about him is he did everything right. He did the right kind, from what we know about aging, you know, he did the right kind of cardiovascular exercise and nutrition. And he was a medic at D-Day, just to situate him in history. And he practiced medicine till he was 70 as an anesthesiologist. He retired, got bored, recertified, and became a family physician, practiced till he was 80. And in his 80s, he was traveling all over the world and doing various kinds of collections and stimulating his brain perfectly. But even Stanley Kuransky, when he hit 89, started to notice that he couldn't remember names at parties, and his driving deteriorated. He was losing his sort of mental energy and concentration, which most people would say, well, he's getting old, right? And just leave it at that. Stanley, you've had a good run. But he heard about this program I describe in the book, which involves brain exercises that retune the brain. An aging brain becomes like a radio station that's slightly off channel, and it can't do crisp representations of sound. And that's what led to his problems. And he did the program on top of everything else he did, 5 days a week for an hour and 6 weeks into it, which is sort of a typical kind of dosage. All of his problems reversed. His memory was crisp, driving improved, his energy improved, and so on. And we now have good university studies, several of them, that show that this particular program described in the book can reverse, for the average person, their loss, so that an 80-year-old can function like a 70-year-old. Mm-hmm. And some people actually went back 25 years. And so imagine if we reconceive of ourselves.
So we have a sort of 40-year-old's attention span and acuity rather than...
Yeah, or that, you know, we start, those of us who are actually do exercise instead of waiting for the impulse to exercise to pass, added mental exercise and maybe did a blast of it for 6 weeks to get going.
In this particular program that he did, was it actual memory training per se?
No.
No, it was something else and it came by the side door, was it?
Yeah, this is what's so intriguing about the neuroplastic interventions in general. If you want, if you're having trouble reading or if you're having trouble remembering names, the interventions aren't necessarily more reading or more memory of names. We go into the brain and figure out what mental functions are there. So in this situation, what happens is as you get older, you lose the ability to encode fast speech sounds that have to, and they're usually vowel consonant combinations like ba, pa, and things like that. And so you actually listen for much of this to funny sounds of sounds going whoop, 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 whoop. And they're going faster and faster and faster. And you learn to differentiate them. You learn to differentiate other sounds. And when you finish this somewhat bizarre intervention, which is kind of fun to do, I think, what you find is, you know, you go to a party and your memory's improved. And there's spillover effects. They have a visual program now that's picked up by a lot of U.S. insurance companies. Because people who do their visual brain program get into fewer car accidents.
Gee. Okay, Norman Doidge is our very welcome guest. He's written The Brain That Changes Itself, a book that has been reprinted 12 times in Australia since it was published in 2007. So we're interested. Norman, you also talk about the competitive plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what you've alluded to, but this is the phrase you use. You stop doing, if you stop doing the activity that is controlled by a certain area of the brain, then that area will be colonized by something else.
Yes.
Could you give us an example, please?
Well, I'll give you two examples. One, if one was a carpenter and one's middle finger was cut off, in your brain there's a map basically for each of the fingers, a sensory map and a motor map. So let's just talk about the sensory map. So if you no longer have input into your brain from your third or middle finger, what you will find is that the map for the second finger and the fourth finger will expand into that brain area that is now lying fallow, if you will. But there's also dramatic examples of which will have major implications for people with disabilities. If you and I were to be completely blindfolded, absolute darkness, that's very, very important, then have our brain scanned, after several hours, our so-called visual cortex, which is at the back of the brain in the occipital lobe, which all the textbooks say is the visual cortex, will begin to process sound and touch. And not only that, you'll get better at hearing and processing sound. A beautiful experiment was done in Spain where people started to notice instead of a loud roar outside, that there was motorcycles, and within a few hours they could differentiate the different kinds of motorcycles and how close they were and how far they were, etc. So it seems that although we thought, you know, most, when we had the machine-like model of the brain, we thought there was, you know, each brain, the brain was divided into areas, and each area performed one mental function in one location. But some of these in our cortex are easily reassigned.
Look, last question, really. I just wonder how you might apply this to something that I'm certainly interested in, multitasking. There's been a very interesting debate just emerging of late about whether really multitasking, which we're all asked to do in the workplace these days, is really producing optimal behaviour and concentration and joy. How does this fit? How do you fit your thoughts into
I don't like multitasking. You know, in general, studies show that there's some suggestions that, for instance, the left and right hemispheres are better connected in women and that women are better at multitasking than men. But regardless of that, you know, multitasking is happening for a variety of reasons. One of them is technological, that suddenly now many forms of input are coming at everybody all at once. And I'm fond of saying, you know, there is no divinity, you know, or minister in charge of this technological revolution and how it's affecting us. But put simply, if you want to learn something, it's a very, very old-fashioned statement. It really helps to pay concerted attention to do it. And if you want to do something well, it helps you to do that.
It's so central to your argument.
Yes. And so all the studies that have been done of multitasking in general show that people don't do things as well. I mean, these are very detailed, interesting studies. It takes a certain amount of mental effort and time to switch from topic A to topic B. And if you're truly multitasking, or activity A to activity B, you're constantly shifting your brain and booting up some circuitry and turning down other circuitry. And it's pretty inefficient, in fact. And it's draining and stressful. Now, some people will come out with a study that'll say you could train people to get better at multitasking. But that goes back to the wisdom question, which is, yeah, you can train people to do just about anything, you know. You can train people to be slaves and good slaves and so on and so forth. Is it a good thing to do? And in general, I think it's not a good thing to do.
So values
internalized by our institutions, because we're the institution, again, it has no head. It's multitasking too. It doesn't have an executive function sometimes. It's just saying, get it done and get it done by this, you know, this time. So, I'm a militant anti-multitasker.
I didn't realise that when I asked you the question. Well, thank you very much indeed, Norman Doidge. It's been a great pleasure to meet you, and I do hope we see you again here in Australia.
It's been delightful to be here.
Norman Doidge, and I know that he wowed Brisbane people with at this year's Writers Festival. His book is The Brain That Changes Itself. It's a Scribe publication. And can I tell you that chapter 10 in particular on rejuvenation is really something to read. I mean, a lot of it is, but that sort of distills it all. And of course, our own Natasha Mitchell introduced me to Norman Doidge in her early discoveries, earlier coverage of him in All in the Mind. So if you go to her website, you can see a lot about neuroplasticity. And again, love to hear from you about multitasking and other things.